It's November the 19th, 2011. This is the New Democratic Podcast. On today's show, he gathered a lot of attention in the federal election and was by Jack Layton's side for the first policy announcement of the 2011 campaign. NDP 2011 candidate for MP, Mark LaFerriere. A former small business owner, union training director, and a relentless workplace safety advocate, now he's the ONDP's critic for labor, infrastructure, community safety, and correctional services, Ontario MPP Taras Natashak. Finally, elected in 2006 to Ed Broadbent's old riding of Ottawa Centre, he was the NDP foreign affairs critic until he announced his candidacy for leadership at the federal NDP, Paul Dewar. The New Democratic Podcast is not affiliated with the New Democratic Party of Canada. All opinions expressed therein are the properties of their respective owners. And welcome to the New Democratic Podcast. My name is Kevin Tolan. I'll be your host. This is our first edition of this podcast. We hope to bring it to you about every other week. We'll try to shore up an exact frequency for these podcasts as time goes on, although I expect we'll have a lot to report on during the leadership race. I myself recently moved to the Ottawa area, and I thought what better way to highlight the wonderful talent that we have within the NDP and provide a platform for various MPs from the area, not just the NDP MPs that are out there, but everyone who wants to speak about social democracy. As I mentioned on today's show, we're going to have three interviews. We'll also cover some news items of the week that relate to social democracy. And as the show evolves, we'll probably also end up having some panel discussions as well, although this first edition will not contain any panel discussions. And without further ado, we're going to go ahead and get right into the first interview with Mark LaFerriere. Mark, of course, was the NDP candidate for MP from the riding of Brant in Ontario in 2011, and he's thrown his full weight of support behind Romeo Saganash in the leadership race. This interview was recorded on Remembrance Day 2011. Mark, why don't you tell us a little bit about your background? What made you want to get involved with advocacy?
We didn't have a car. We didn't have any way to get to and from school other than the school bus. And I had to rely on teachers when I was in high school in order to get to and from school after school if I wanted to be involved in anything else, you know. Later, working in the poverty, anti-poverty movement, you learn a lot about inclusion and exclusion and how that's one of the best indicators of poverty. Anyhow, we didn't have a school bus. We didn't have a city bus, I should say, that went to our school. I was 14. I was the junior vice president of my school. And I thought, I didn't know what I was doing, but I thought, hey, let's get a petition together. We got over 1,000 signatures on a petition. And we went to the city hall. And it was pretty intense when you're 14 to go to city hall. And there was lots of people there. There were lots of people watching. The paper, one of the papers did a story on it. And it's funny, actually, right before I ran, I was going through, so I guess this would have been 2008, 2009. I was going through some of my files, old files. And I came across the newspaper clipping. So yeah, if people go to my website, brantmark.ca, and they go in the news section, what they can do is they can actually, if you go to the bottom of it, you can see that old press clipping of, my first bit of advocacy, I guess, getting to City Hall and saying, there's a lot of folks, poor kids like me, who don't have access to after school programs because we don't have a ride. And our school was so far away from where a lot of us who went there lived that it just wasn't fair. But then all the other high schools had it. So I got a bit of a taste for it then. And then I started working with Youth Leadership Camps Canada, got involved in student leadership, student advocacy, media. One thing led to another, and from there got involved with social work, child and youth work at first, and then social work, and a lot of movements, and community development, which is how I tried to base my campaign, not necessarily on the big money advertising model that a lot of writings and a lot of political parties use, but trying to do community good, community advocacy, community work, community engagement, and win or lose. Well, at least we've helped change some things. And, even though we did lose and, that's disappointing, we still were able to do a lot to change the local culture of politics. And And that's really rewarding.
What was your education like, and how did it help you when you ran for MP?
Well, you know, I had education from the high school level at Assumption here. I always call that a leadership incubation period. But I went to Ottawa U for university at first and got a degree in communications and English lit there. And I joined the debating society while I was there. And my goodness, some of the people we would debate with, well, actually, some of them are pundits now. So that always helped, I guess, being this young guy working with future, you know, lobbyists and pundits and strategists. So that was pretty interesting. The proximity to Parliament Hill was pretty incredible. And actually, I worked in the media in Ottawa, and I was able, that's where I was first able to meet a lot of politicians, people who impressed me, like Preston Manning, which most people might be shocked that this NDPer looks up to Preston Manning, but I do. And actually, I think anybody should look into what Preston's been doing lately around science and his advocacy for science and trying to get science-based decisions in government, which I really like. But it's also where I got to meet Sven Robinson for the first time, who very much impressed me, and, of course, Jack Layton. And I thought I would be this punk kid who would ask Jack Layton all the tough questions, and I did, to my mind, but lo and behold, he answered them quite easily and won me over. And actually, that was the beginning of my journey as a New Democrat. After doing child and youth work for a while, and amazing Indigenous program there, and also social work, both at Lake Hattaralia and in Thunder Bay, started getting involved with more movements. That was more recently, 2007, 2008. And just, you know, you see what's out there, and you see the stories of despair, but you also see the stories of hope, and you see how policy can do good and policy can do bad. And if people don't get involved, then we get the least good out of the policy that we create. So, you know, it's interesting. I love two things. I love the micro courses on things like counseling, and I love the macro stuff on policy, and that's very rare. And I think being an MP would actually suit that quite well, because you have to be such a strong constituency person, but you also have to have a big picture. And I think that balancing those and connecting those are so important. And I think that sometimes gets lost in current policymaking.
When you decided to run for MP, did you approach your riding association, or did they approach you?
Well, no, they approached me. Brian Van Tilburg, who was the federal candidate before I and was the provincial candidate in the last election, great guy. He approached me to join the Riding Association. We were both members of the Brantford Roundtable on Poverty, and he had been through an election or two by then. And I really liked Brian, and I started talking to him outside of the Roundtable, and he had me join the Riding Association. And I got to tell you, when we started, I guess that'd be 3-4 years ago now, that Riding Association was about 5 people big, and I was the youngest by far. And before me, Brian was the youngest. And there was about a year there where people from the Riding Association, as it started to grow and get more and more people, they kept asking me if I'd run. Brian kept trying to court me to run. And, you know, it didn't appeal to me. I really liked politics, and I really liked the idea of getting involved. But I thought, you know, I just got back from school. At the time I was 27 years old, and I thought, you know, I don't know how that's going to work. But as time went on, and I became more involved and more involved, and I kept getting asked, you know, the more you get asked, you start saying, well, you know, if these people would support me, then maybe there's something we can do. And the more and more of those people who started being supportive, the more I thought about it, the more seriously I thought about it, and took the leap. Actually, funny story, the campaign turned into quite a big campaign by the end of it, you know, hundreds of people volunteering, and Jack Layton coming several times, and like the first policy announcement of the campaign, some amazing stuff. But the beginning of my campaign was the same day that a local radio station had fired a lot of its employees. So I'd announced a press conference. And one reporter and a student photographer came, and I had a 10-minute speech prepared, and I went through it anyway. But from little things, good things can come. We really developed quite a team, and it was excellent to be a part of, but it, you know, didn't always seem like it would be that way.
Brent seems to have a large youth grassroots contingent. What have you done to encourage more youth involvement?
One of the things was just getting those on board. Those older folks and youth, you know, they're not at cross purposes. The older folks love having the youth, and the youth actually like the guidance of some of the older folks. So you know, to bring them all together and not have that disempowering hierarchy. You know, I think it helped that I was a candidate who was 28, 27, 28 years old, when I started, because I wasn't that far off from the youth category myself. I'd done a lot of youth engagement, and we had one or two youth, who had volunteered consistently in three campaigns before that. And they're actually still very much involved and amazing, but it just grew. I have to say, to any riding association considering a youth wing, start it with one person. We had one person when we started the youth wing, and now I'd say it's one of the most active in the country. And they, you know, we help them get involved. We help them do things. We help them fundraise, but they take the ball themselves and they run with it. You know, let's go shovel some driveways. Let's go, shovel some sidewalks, you know, for people who need it. Let's go, start a youth leadership conference. We have an annual youth leadership conference here now, and it's a YNDP Brandt event, but we open it up and we've had conservatives, liberals, Green Party, former candidates, anybody who has any positive impact to have on youth, we'll have them there. So do those things, get them involved and get out there. Have some fun, musical events also, you know, just to get people out. It becomes a social thing. And I got to tell you, when these young people, I mean, they knock on doors and, you know, they lift your spirits and they really believe, and it's contagious. That enthusiasm is contagious. So any riding association, don't make politics just for the adults and the older folks. Really, even if it's awkward at first, engage those young people, ask them what they want to do, value them. It's incredible.
You've really gotten behind community gardens. Why are community gardens a good idea?
Well, community gardens are a great idea for a lot of reasons. One is the environmental piece. That stewardship is very important. But another is poverty. The access to healthy foods is dwindling in some areas. I'm a social worker, and I've had clients who have gone to community gardens to get, you know, some social aspect, some health aspect. It's very healthy to be gardening, to get food, and to be part of something. Now, one of the things that we've done in Brandt is the community gardens were founded. Myself and a few other folks co-founded the community gardens here, and it's grown from one project to 14. But what made them very unique was they were healing, was the number one sort of push we had. And when I say that, we have a lot of healing that needs to happen between the settler community in the city and the county and the Six Nations community. And, you know, on one side of the street, we had land rights issues and protests. And on another side of the street, the same street, we had two communities working together to make thousands of pounds of fresh vegetables and medicines that were mostly donated, actually, to the food bank. So it's a pretty big success story from my point of view.
Who has inspired you?
Lately, you know, with the leadership race coming, it's starting to sink in even more. I know there's that initial grief, and I'm going to talk like a social worker for a bit here maybe, but, you know, it's a reminder, and it's actually difficult to not think about Jack Layton almost every day, about some aspect of something, you know, that he was doing. And, I feel bad in a way for a lot of leadership candidates because they're being measured against that measuring stick, and those are impossible shoes to fill. But by the same token, I think everybody is also inspired by Jack's legacy. So Jack's one. I've also been lucky enough to work with folks at Canada Without Poverty like Ed Broadbent and Monique Bégin, Joe Clark, Ovid Mekredi. These are people I find incredibly inspiring. And to see, you know, Ed is a party saint, and to see him work so well with folks like Joe Clark and Monique Bégin, who is Trudeau's health minister, and to see just, you know, how what we can do when we actually put the partisanship aside on all sides. That's very inspiring as well. You know, and locally there's been a lot of great folks that I try to learn from everyone. You know, there are good ideas everywhere, and every party's right sometimes, including ours, and every party's wrong sometimes, including ours. We're very lucky. We had one of the least partisans come out of Brandt, an MP named Derek Blackburn. And him and his wife, Monique, have been a huge help and a huge inspiration to myself and my partner, Rebecca. You know, Derek calls me pretty regularly and gives me advice, even still, even post-election. you know, on where to go from here. And it's very, very, very helpful. He was an MP here for 22 years and just still beloved, you know, still get, oh, Derek, when you knock on the doors. So I was really happy that he could come. He actually came a few times, and one of the times he came down was 2 days before the election, and we did a 10 to 12 hour campaign day, and he is 76 or 78 now. And my goodness, if I can be half as good as he is campaigning at his age one day, then I'd be very, very lucky indeed.
What do you think about the NDP leadership race?
I think it is an embarrassment of riches, and I think it really turns the media hoopla about our lack of a deep bench on its head. You know, you have nine candidates, all of whom bring something unique to the table, all of whom are very diverse. This isn't, you know, 14 lawyers running. Nothing wrong with lawyers, but I just like the diversity. And you probably still have another 10 or so New Democrats who could run for leadership and aren't. You know, folks like Charlie Angus and Megan Leslie and Libby Davies and Peter Julian, and I can go on and on. And yet, the NDP had this tag of not having a deep bench after Jack passed away, and it's just not true. I mean, that's a pretty deep bench right there. Myself, I'm proud to be supporting Romeo Saganash. He is the first First Nations person to ever seek any leadership of any party. And, you know, he's a very new MP, but in my mind and to my liking, he has the best resume outside of being an MP. And we need more negotiators in Parliament, and we need more negotiators in the party. And he is one of the most successful negotiators in the country. And he just brings with him a calmness, a steadiness, and a passion that I think is a very rare mix. Now, I think there are so many other good candidates as well. You know, I really like Thomas Mulcair, to be frank. I really like Nikki Ashton. Peggy Nash has been incredible, as is Brian Topp. I don't know Robert Chisholm or Nathan Cullen too well. I don't know Martin Singh too well. But Paul Dewar has been personally very helpful. But, you know, Romeo and his team have done some incredible things. I want to start the hashtag No Bad Choices, because I think that this leadership race has no bad choices. My personal preference is Romeo Saganash, just an incredible guy. And actually, I'm happy to be working on his team, not just endorsing him, but working on his communications and some of his strategy. Very much a guy who can bring a lot of unity to the party and the country.
Would you run again for Member of Parliament?
You know, an interesting thing happened during this run is we had, you know, lots of people come and help out. But we also, after the election, I can't tell you how many people I had email me, Facebook me, call me, bump into on the street who said a few different things. One, they said they thought they had to vote Liberal. We had a huge problem with that, those sites that just, they don't look at anything that's happening on the ground. They just look at the last election results. And so that's very encouraging. People who said, you know, I wanted to vote for you, but I thought I had to. And I appreciate that kind of honesty from people. And even though the Liberals locally didn't win a single poll, and it became a race between the NDP and the Conservatives, I like that people were very honest. It gives me a very frank way to go forward. The other thing that happened were even people who did volunteer and people who didn't were writing and talking to me to say, you know, I was looking at the air war, for lack of a better term, the newspapers, the coverage, the media, and I thought you had it. So I only volunteered once. If you run again, I'd like to volunteer from day one all the way through. I myself learned a lot as well. I helped out on John Rafferty and Bruce Heyer's campaigns, but I'd never been a candidate myself. And luckily, people like Brian Van Tilburg and Derek Blackburn helped me out quite a lot. But I do think that next time, from the lessons of this time, I'd be an even better candidate. Just, you know, there's nothing like doing it once to actually understand what you're supposed to be doing. I would run again if I could get the support. So, you know, it's not one of those things where I can't just decide to run. I would like to put my name forward. But, you know, there needs to be a nomination process. There needs to be a nomination meeting. I need to win that nomination. And to do that, I need to have all the grassroots support possible. So I'm getting a lot of support from folks. And it's something I'm definitely considering. And it's something I really enjoy doing. But again, it needs to be a whole community effort. And we'll cross that bridge when we come to it. But it was a very good experience.
Mark LeFerrier, thank you very much for spending time with us today.
Oh, well, thank you so much. And just if people want to connect, if they want to either offer support or if they want to ask questions, they can reach me on Facebook at facebook.com/BrantMark, on Twitter at Mark LaFerriere, or you know what, just go to my webpage, Brant Mark, that's M-A-R-C, brantmark.ca, and all the links are there. And I'd really like to connect with anybody who'd like to connect with me. Thanks.
Mark called in via Skype from Brant, Ontario. When he first ran federally in 2006, he had only 22% of the vote in Essex and was in third place. But in 2008, he increased that by about 4%, and in 2011, increased that figure by nearly 9% of the vote. He then ran provincially later in the year and won by picking up an additional 3% of the vote. He's the man that epitomizes the phrase, "If at first you don't succeed, try again." I'm of course talking about Taras Natoshak, MPP from the riding of Essex and the ONDP's critic for labor, infrastructure, community safety, and correctional services. This interview was conducted on November the 12th, 2011. So, Taras, you ran in three federal elections before running provincially and winning. Each time you ran, you gained a larger percentage of the vote. In some places in Canada, such as Alberta, where they've seen 40 years now of progressive conservative rule, people just won't vote for you unless you belong to a party that they usually vote for. So my question for you is, what's so different about your riding, Essex, that makes it possible for a third party standing to win?
Well, great question. I guess the dynamic that rests within the riding of Essex is a lot different than the entirety of the province of Alberta. This riding specifically has a mix of urban and rural demographics. It lies on the outset of the two Windsor ridings, Windsor West and Windsor Tecumseh. And Essex has a history of going all three ways, New Democrat, Liberal, and Tory way back in the past provincially, although it's been quite some time since we've had a Tory member of provincial parliament. But certainly federally, it's gone all three ways as well, with the Liberals holding the majority of that balance as representatives. So what's the difference? Well, I guess issues are different. The province is different. The makeup of the people that live in this riding are different too as well. When it comes to just, running as a candidate under a certain banner, I think that, possibly the residents of the riding of Essex, I can only speak to, this riding, I think they tend to discount party politics a lot easier than maybe Albertans would, and look more closely at their individual representatives as people, what their backgrounds are, how long they've been in the community, and what they've done, and of course your candidacy and your campaign plays a large part, where you what your vision is for this riding. So I guess all the factors led to eventual success here in this riding. I kind of knew that if I stuck around long enough, that folks in this riding would appreciate that determination, that dedication. I think that's indicative, and it's sort of quintessential Essex County politics, that they want to see that you're dedicated to the cause, and I certainly am. So, that paid dividends in October, and I'm proud to now be their representative for the province.
In several of your speeches, you've talked about Pat Hayes, the last NDP MPP from Essex. Who was Pat Hayes, and what did he teach you about being a public servant?
Well, Pat, first and foremost, was a good friend of mine. He was my political mentor. He was the member of provincial parliament for the riding of Essex in the 80s, as well as under the Bob Rae government in the 90s. He was a wonderful guy. So I was fortunate enough to grow up as a youngster within the Pat Hayes tenure as the member of provincial parliament. My mum was his constituency assistant here in the riding, so I was exposed to a lot of the aspects of provincial government early on, and Pat was Truly a grassroots representative for the riding. He was well known, comes from a large, well-known family here in the county. Pat was my campaign manager for my first campaign in 2005-06, as well as 2008, and became ill in 2010 wasn't able to play a part, an active part, in my federal campaign in 2011. But he was certainly there in spirit with us, subsequently passed away on May the 2nd, Election Day, which was quite ironic and something that that I look back on as feeling as though Pat passed on Election Day, because he knew that he couldn't play a physical part, but he could play a larger part spiritually. And we all know the successes that we had federally on May the 2nd as a party. I did speak with him prior to his passing about the possibility of, should I not be successful in the May federal election, the consideration of running provincially in his former position. And he certainly, advocated that I do that. And he felt as though that would be a good step. And I took it, and now I'm honored to have the same position that he held, and I'm going to attempt to represent the riding in the same fashion that he did, as being a grassroots type of member, as visible as possible, but also someone who's able to relate the issues of everyday people in Essex County to the Ontario Legislature. And I think maybe that was Pat's key to his success. He was just your common everyday person who was really able to relate with others, and something that I think is missing in all levels of politics. We sort of forget where we come from and forget who we represent, and those are the issues that have to come first and foremost, are the issues that are important to people on the ground in your riding, and not necessarily the partisan politics and those partisan gains that it seems as though parties are looking for these days. So Pat was a wonderful guy. I miss him terribly, but I look at his name on the marble wall as I walk through the halls of the Ontario Legislature each and every day, and I remember how much he helped and how proud I think he would be of our accomplishments here in Essex.
You've been handed quite an impressive portfolio, including critic for labor, which is a very senior post. Ontario now has unemployment at 8.1% with 75,400 lost jobs in October and a gain of 36,600 part-time jobs. Mm-hmm. Most of the jobs lost were in manufacturing and construction. So what are the Liberals doing wrong, and what would the NDP do differently?
Well, you touched on my portfolio appointment, and I am honored to receive that portfolio. I think it was given to me because of a sort of a long history, not only by myself, but this riding, being in the manufacturing sector and the heartland of manufacturing in southwestern Ontario. I think we have a good understanding of what the needs are in terms of those blue-collar jobs that we've been losing so rapidly. In Ontario and Canada at large, the challenges ahead are to try to let the government, both provincially and federally, understand, or make them understand, that the losses of these good-paying manufacturing jobs are systemic. They are indicative of failed trade policies. They're indicative of a lack of policies and priorities when it comes to manufacturing strategies, or domestic procurement policies too, as well. We think, as New Democrats, that those good-paying manufacturing jobs deserve to be back in this province, and we have to actively protect them. And just a history of watching successive governments literally sell off these good-paying manufacturing jobs to the lowest-wage jurisdictions on the planet. Needless to say, we believe that it's incumbent upon the provincial government of Ontario, as well as our federal level of government too, as well, to play an active part in protecting and promoting our manufacturing sector. And that means initiatives, again, such as procurement policy that would ensure that if we spent a dollar in this province, we spent it on a company that employed Ontario workers too as well, instead of outsourcing and looking to the cheapest product that we can find. Let's add that value and ensure that when we make a purchase, it's supporting local communities. But labor in general has some pretty serious issues. There are issues within labor law issues too as well, ensuring that workers who don't work in unionized positions are safeguarded, that the Employment Standards Act is enforced adequately. A lot of health and safety aspects and issues are front and center too as well. So a whole host of issues that are ready to be tackled, and they fall within also some of the frameworks of the other credit portfolios that I've received, the infrastructure portfolio too as well, and community safety and correctional services too as well. So I've got a big job ahead of me, but certainly ready and willing to take on that challenge, and excited to have good leadership and a lot of experience within the benches of our NDP party here in Ontario.
When you were young, you went with your family to the Ambassador Bridge and protested the free trade agreement. Do you think that we need trade protectionism?
Yeah, we too often, the word protectionism is portrayed in a negative light, and typically by corporate interests on mainstream media outlets too as well. I think that it's high time that all governments realize that it's so important to protect our good paying jobs, to protect our resources too as well, and to leverage them as a vital and strategic asset. Yeah, do we have to enact protectionist measures? Not so much in terms of blockades, but we have to ensure that trade agreements such as the CETA agreement, the Comprehensive Economic Trading Agreement that we're in the process of negotiating with the European Union, we got to ensure that that agreement and those types of agreements don't sell off our good-paying manufacturing jobs, our resources, and our ability to maintain some level of sovereignty within our country here, whether it be in our agricultural products, our natural resources, or simply our the manufacturing of our raw materials. Those are what's on the table there, and I think it's imperative that Canadians pay attention to what's on the table and to ask questions of their levels of government, because these things seem to fly under the radar, and then lo and behold, we've lost 10,000 or 20,000 manufacturing jobs in any given month. Those are as a direct result to trading agreements that don't value or that put workers at a disadvantage. Is it time? I think it is high time that we take a proactive approach to protecting jobs, whatever facet that takes. Certainly trading agreements, and the ones that are being negotiated to our detriment need to be evaluated. Hopefully this minority government situation in Ontario gives us the ability to hold at least the provincial government to account when it comes time to leveraging some of our strategic resources within these types of negotiations.
As you mentioned earlier, you are also the critic for community safety and correctional services. What do you think about the federal Conservative government's crime bill and how it would affect the provinces?
Well, we knew the federal government had an omnibus bill on the agenda for quite some time. We knew that they were attempting to roll in a whole host of issues into one massive bill, and under close review of our party at the federal level, and also throughout the provinces, we know that it looks as though it's a hard line on crime, but it really does not do anything to deter criminal activity. It's been argued at many levels, at the provincial level, within committees, that they're taking the wrong approach on crime and how we deal with crime in Canada. We've even heard testimony from within federal committees through administrators in Texas who have counseled our levels of government to not take the approach on mandatory minimum sentencing as a deterrent. It doesn't do anything to decrease the level of recidivism within criminal activity, and it becomes a massively expensive exercise in our criminal system. So a whole host of issues within community safety and correctional services. I mean, you know, the requirement, the need for some new facilities, penitentiaries, but also the need to look at maintaining some facilities too as well. They're cutting where they shouldn't, and they're building where they necessarily don't need to. I'm going to be happy to lend a second set of eyes onto that policy and to that portfolio, and happy to work with those stakeholders too within that jurisdiction and our safety and officers too as well, and public servants that work within that framework. Looking forward to hearing their ideas and their concepts. When we know that crime rates overall in Canada are ever reducing and decreasing, are we making smart investments within that area? And could we not put more of a focus on deterrents such as education, job creation, and training, community efforts too as well, working with community groups to avoid criminal activity at the outset. So those are longstanding principles of the New Democratic Party, and certainly looking forward to again playing an active role on that file.
Our final question of the day, you've got a wonderful young family there. How hard is it to balance family and being an MPP?
it's difficult. It's a challenge. But it's something that my wife and I have been preparing for quite some time. We kind of knew that this was potentially an eventuality here within our family. It's something that she knew I was passionate about. And, to have a partner that understands the nature of the job, that is so helpful and understanding and willing to take on the same sacrifices that I do. Also, my kids are awesome. They understand what daddy's doing. They get a sense. We were at Queen's Park for the swearing in ceremony. They get a sense of that big building and how important the work is that I'll be doing there. There's a sense of pride too as well. So it's not as if I'm away, doing something that really doesn't matter. They understand that there's something that's going on that's quite special. So it's tough on a personal note, but we've decided and we understand that the sacrifices are worth it, and we're very close too as well. So we'll take the job as it is, as it comes. The time that we spend together as a family are going to be that much more important and that much more special, because it will be few and far between. But we're all excited too as well. Not only, my immediate family, my wife and my two kids, but my extended family who have all lended so much support, my mom and dad, my in-laws too as well, and lots of close family. So I'm really fortunate to have a great staff, and that makes it easier to get in and bury my nose in a whole bunch of work and get the job done. And I think that's what the people that's riding are looking forward to me doing, because that's certainly what I campaigned on, is somebody who's going to work as hard as they've ever seen their member of provincial parliament work. And that's certainly something that I'm looking forward to.
Taras, thank you very much for taking the time to talk with us today.
Kev, it has been an absolute pleasure. I'm so happy that you're doing this, and I'm looking forward to, a great great new adventure in provincial parliament, and also some great things to come for the party across this country. So thanks again.
Taras Nedeshak is the NDP critic for Ontario for Labour, Community Safety and Correctional Services and Infrastructure, and he's the MPP for the riding of Essex. We reached him today in his home in Bell River. And now for a look at the news. years. The NDP has announced plans for debates for the leadership candidates. Each debate will focus on different core issues. Cities chosen for the debates include Ottawa, Halifax, Quebec City, Winnipeg, Montreal, Vancouver, and Toronto. For more details, go to leadership2012.ndp.ca. NDP MP Pat Martin is making headlines due to a tweet he issued that contained some foul language. He is unapologetic, claiming that what the Conservatives are doing to limit debate in the House is jackbooted, likening it to what happens in third world countries. He has not been disciplined by the party for his actions. Two NDP MPs have been disciplined by the party for not following voting instructions on the long gun registry vote. MPs John Rafferty and Bruce Heyer, both from neighboring ridings on the north shores of Lake Superior in Ontario, voted in favor of scrapping the long gun registry, which has been very deeply unpopular in rural NDP ridings. Neither MP will be able to make statements or ask questions in the Commons chamber. Both MPs also lose their critic roles. NDP MPs Megan Leslie and Claude Gravel headed down to Washington to comment on the Keystone XL pipeline and specifically on NDP desires to tighten environmental controls on the Alberta tar sands. For doing this, the Conservatives expressed their frustration with the NDP via the Prime Minister, claiming, quote, "The NDP is kind of proof that the devil lives and interferes in the affairs of men." The NDP, of course, continues on its course of helping the poor and disadvantaged to take stewardship for the earth, and to oppose reckless and unnecessary wars while not allowing the Conservatives to claw back the pensions of veterans and the benefits of their spouses. And I say, if that's the devil's work, then so be it. As the leadership campaign progresses, my travels last week took me to the Political Pints with Paul Dewar event at Carleton University. Let's have a listen and hear why some of the students and area community members were there to chat with Paul and have a pint.
So what's your name?
Sean Carroll.
And Sean, are you here for the Pints with Paul event?
I'm not here for Paul, but he already has my vote.
So you're just here for the beer?
And I guess having one with Paul?
There you go. Okay, well that makes it easy on Paul then. He doesn't have to convince you because you're already going to vote for him.
He's got a drink with me.
All right, thanks, Ben. All right, so what's your name?
I'm Jim.
And Jim, why did you come to the Pints with Paul Dewar event tonight?
Well, I'm in solidarity with the Occupy movement, and I'm trying to bring about an end to capitalism, and I thought this was a good first step.
Excellent. So are you in the Socialist Caucus of the NDP?
No, I think they're a little bit out to lunch.
All right. Well, thank you very much. All right, and so why are you at the Pints with Paul event, and what's your name, first off?
It's Liam McCarthy.
Okay, and why are you here?
I'm just here to support Paul, and I'm always there to support Paul and the Dewar family any way I can. I just, as a trade unionist, I know that he's solid in his principles, and he comes out of a solid trade union background and social justice background, and having known his mother as well, I know that he's... he's very committed to doing concrete things to achieve the kind of objectives that I believe in, and I know absolutely where he stands on things, and I'm very comfortable with where he would take the party.
So you already knew in advance that he had your vote. Is that fair to say?
Oh, absolutely. He's absolutely. He has my vote, and he would know that in advance as well. Yeah.
All right, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And now we go on to speak with the man himself. Paul Dewar, of course, is the MP for Ottawa Centre, and he is running for leadership of the NDP. This interview was recorded on November the 17th, 2011.
All right, so I'm at Carleton U here, and I've got Paul Dewar with me. And he's graciously agreed to do a little interview here on our first edition of the New Democratic Podcast. And I just wanted to start by asking, earlier today, you visited Occupy Ottawa. What are your thoughts on that movement and their right to protest indefinitely in public?
Well, first of all, thanks for doing this program, and I think it's exciting for New Democrats and for others who are interested in progressive politics that this kind of program exists. You know, I think that the Occupy movements right across this country and the ones I've visited are an organic expression of what people are feeling about the injustice in our economy. And fundamentally for New Democrats, I think, and for Social Democrats, we are concerned about unfairness in the economy in particular. And I think what we've seen in Occupies right across the country is really focusing on that. Just in terms of your question around, you know, the ability for people to use public spaces indefinitely to protest, I think there's an obvious balance here, but I think the key is, you know, people have charter rights to be able to participate and to express their opinion. And I think it's a matter of just keeping a balance on, you know, what those democratic rights are, and obviously understanding that there's responsibilities, but fundamentally people are wanting to express their concerns about government, about the economy, and I think that's something that should be supported, even if you don't agree with them and what they're saying. Their right to express themselves is absolutely critical. I think some of the things that have come out are very well thought out. That, you know, we're looking at a widening and a gap between those who have and those who don't. And, you know, that's something I think everyone would agree we have to deal with. And even those who are harsh critics have said, yeah, probably not a bad idea that we look at that question. So, no, I think it's something that, you know, people have to obviously take with some responsibility in terms of how they're behaving, and I've seen that with many of the people who are involved in Occupy, and good on them, because they're also understanding that their voice is going to be evaluated also on how they behave. And for now, I think it's gone well here in Ottawa, and I haven't seen any problems.
You were instrumental in creating legislation to ban the toxin bisphenol A, also known as BPA. Why was that important legislation for Canadians?
I think it was critical because often what happens is that manufacturers create products without due diligence. And in our country, in fact, in Department of Health and Environment, they're supposed to be guided by the precautionary principle. And the precautionary principle is basically states that if there is even the likelihood of a concern to human health, then there should be action taken and regulation put into place. When it comes to bisphenol A, what I found was that there was enough research out there that there should be regulation put in to ensure that there wasn't further damage or potential damage, sorry, to human health. One of the things about bisphenol A is that there is potential endochromic disruption, which essentially means that you're messing with the map, the DNA map, and endochromes of humans, and that this can do a lot of damage to our health. And we were seeing bisphenol A in water bottles and infants' toys and baby bottles, and I thought it was really important that this be addressed. And I also thought more fundamentally, as a member of Parliament, I knew that I could put forward private members' legislation, and if we got the attention of government, they might actually adopt it. And I'm a pragmatist that way, and lo and behold, the government did adopt my bill, and I was very proud of that. But in terms of the importance of the issue, it's about human health. It's about ensuring not only do we have the precautionary principle in our documents that government's supposed to be guided by, but that we actually see that when we are looking at legislation and regulation.
What would a Paul Dewar NDP opposition look like that would make it different from an NDP opposition led by anybody else?
Ah, that's a very good question. I would build an opposition team that would work on this with the strengths that we have in our team, and that would give our shadow cabinet the tools they needed to obviously hold the government to account, but also to develop propositions to show Canadians there's a better way, that there's things we can do, and not just focus on throwing mud at the government and saying that they're wrong. I think it's important to have a strong analysis of the government and hold them to account. But my focus would be on building a team that would be focused on propositional politics, and that would engage with Canadians on the ground to come up with some of these ideas. You know, I've always said that, you know, things like our healthcare system, which we're so proud of and needs support, didn't come out of necessarily a committee debate in Parliament Hill. It came from the grassroots. It came from the people of Saskatchewan who said, you know, this is crazy. We can't take care of our family's health without having to mortgage the farm. And so my belief is that the way to come up with the solutions to the problems we have are to have people engaged, going to people in this country and people who are wanting to participate and engaging with them to come up with the solutions to the problems we face. And so my bench with full of the people we already have who would be engaged in for sure holding the government to account, but also spending a lot of time on coming up with the solutions and the propositions that we need to counter the Harper Conservatives.
How about a Paul Dore NDP government?
Well, then we take it to the next level, wouldn't we? You know, there's so many exciting things that we can do. For instance, on the economy, change the retrograde kind of tax system we have in place right now, where we see, you know, tax breaks given to these large corporations who aren't investing in jobs, who aren't investing in innovation. We would invest in universities for public research and innovation. We would actually deal with climate change in a serious way and make sure that we were funding sustainable projects. We would have an enlightened foreign policy where Canadians would be innovators again in things like peacekeeping, in international development, in corporate social responsibility for corporations that are operating abroad. And we would have Canadians be excited again about what governments can do and not feel as if governments are impotent and that they're not there for them. Maybe to put it in a phrase, it would be that people would see that governments are working for people and not the other way around again.
Excellent. And one final question for you. How will you be keeping in touch with people as your leadership campaign progresses?
A good question from a guy who's using technology in a savvy way. I think it's really important that as a leadership candidate, that I use the web in a way that can connect with people. Obviously through Twitter, through Facebook, but I'm also looking at, and I had one of these the other night, doing conference calls with members to stay connected with them if we can't get to every place, but also through the web to people who are interested in my campaign and want to get in touch with me. We have an access through the web so that they can get in touch with me directly and volunteer on my campaign. And so to use all these tools in a way that allows me and allows people to get connected. But the best way is through volunteers. We've done, our campaign has kind of looked at the strengths of the Obama campaign, had people who are organized through some of the organizers from that campaign, and getting out and organizing people on the ground to organize other people to connect with them. And we're trying to connect with as many members as possible to go out and sign up as many new members as possible. And for that, I'm wonderfully blessed with a lot of really great volunteers that will allow me to connect with many, many people. So through the web, through Facebook, through Twitter, through these conference calls and town halls by the phone, as well as just good old-fashioned face-to-face and getting out and having a good town hall.
Fantastic. Paul, thank you very much for your time.
It was a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Paul Dore is MP for Ottawa Centre, and he is candidate for leadership of the federal NDP. We reached him at Carleton University. And that about does it for the New Democratic podcast. We hope that you have thoroughly enjoyed it. Before we sign off, I'd like to mention that I'm growing a mustache for Movember to raise awareness and funds for men's health, specifically to draw attention to prostate cancer. I need donations, though, so please go to mobro.co, that's mobro.co/tolen. That's my last name, spelled T-O-L-E-N. So that's mobro.co/tolen to donate. Thanks for listening to the first edition of the New Democratic Podcast. If you're an MP, MPP, MLA, or similar, and would like to be on the show, please send me an email. Likewise, if you can help out with the show in some way, feel free to contact me. My Twitter handle is at TotallyTolan, and you can also email me at ktolan@gmail.com. We'll need your help to arrange for bandwidth and to improve our technology as the show progresses. Please spread the word on Facebook and Twitter. Can't emphasize that enough. You'll soon be able to subscribe to the show for free via iTunes. I'm Kevin Tolan, and this is the New Democratic Podcast. Keep fighting the good fight. Don't let them tell you it can't be done.